Have you ever just stared up at the night sky during like a really difficult or confusing moment in your life and just thought, you know, could you just give me a sign?
Oh, yeah. Tons
And
of them.
just a quick, undeniable burning message in the stars so I know for sure that I'm doing the right thing.
Right. It's a deeply human impulse.
Exactly. We all crave certainty, especially when it comes to those massive existential questions about, well, why we are here and whether anyone is actually listening.
Yeah, we want the cheat sheet.
We really do. But what if getting that undeniable burning sign in the sky would actually like ruin the entire point of human
Which
existence?
sounds completely counterintuitive, but.
Right. But that is exactly what we're getting into today. Welcome to today's deep dive. Today we're exploring a truly provocative 2026 essay by Marius Jans, and it's titled The Proof That God Exists.
It is a fascinating read.
It really is. And I want to say right up front, our mission today is to explore this stuff for anyone who is just curious about philosophy. So if you are listening and you don't have a PhD in this stuff, do not worry.
You definitely don't need one.
Right. This is for anyone interested in these big ideas. We're looking at this mind-bending paradox Jans presents. Basically, what if our very uncertainty about God is actually like the strongest argument that a specific kind of God might exist?
Yeah, Jans takes one of the oldest, most intensely debated questions in human history and just completely flips the script.
He really does.
Instead of looking at divine silence as, you know, an absence or a failure, he frames it as a necessary mechanism.
Okay, let's unpack this because Jan starts with a deliberate provocation. His initial thought experiment basically posits that God exists precisely because we do not know whether he
Right,
exists.
which on its face sounds like a circular riddle.
Yeah, like a Zen koan or something. But as he builds his case, it turns into this profound exploration of the hiddenness of God, human freedom, and the absolute weight of moral responsibility.
And we are going to map his essay against a pretty rich backdrop of intellectual history, just to show how his modern ideas connect to centuries of human thought.
From the early theologians to like the heavy hitters of the 19th and 20th centuries,
And
or
exactly. But to understand why a creator might purposefully choose to stay hidden, we really first have to understand the classic philosophical problem that sets up Jans's whole argument.
right, the existence of suffering.
Yeah, known in philosophy as the problem of theodicy.
Right.
The issue is usually formulated as this triad of traits that seem to, well, violently contradict our everyday reality.
Right, because how can a universe be governed by a God who is all-knowing, all-powerful, and perfectly good while immense suffering just continues to happen?
The logic there is usually laid out pretty starkly.
Like, if God is all-powerful, he has the literal ability to stop the suffering, right?
Yeah, and if he is perfectly good, he should actually want to stop it.
And if he's all-knowing, he's entirely aware that it's happening right now.
Exactly. So the fact that pain and cruelty persist just seems to break that triad. People have been trying to solve that specific riddle for thousands of years.
So how does Jans approach it?
Well, he starts by looking at one of the most prominent classical solutions, which is the free will defense.
Ah.
You see the roots of this in the work of Augustine, specifically in his text on free choice of the will. And it was brought into modern philosophy with like incredible rigor by thinkers like Alvin Plantinga.
Right, Plantinga's name comes up a lot here.
It does. And Plantinga argued that it's logically impossible for God to create creatures with genuine free will and at the same time guarantee that those creatures will never do evil.
Because if you guarantee they can't do evil, they aren't free.
Right. The core concept here is that a world containing free human beings who have the actual capacity to choose wrong is fundamentally more valuable than a world of literal automatons who are just forced to do good.
It's kind of like the mechanics of being a parent.
How so?
Well, you could theoretically lock your child in a completely padded room, right?
Right.
You control the environment entirely. They never get a scraped knee, they never encounter a bully, they never get their heart broken, and they never like make a destructive choice.
But locking them in that room prevents them from developing any actual human virtues.
Exactly. Because courage can't exist without the presence of danger.
Right. And genuine compassion really can't exist without the presence of suffering or inequality.
So by removing the possibility of harm, you remove the possibility of moral development.
Yeah, exactly. Under the free will defense, things like atrocities, betrayal, and oppression are not willed by a creator. They are the tragic, unavoidable consequences of granting humans genuine autonomy.
Because without a real devastating alternative, freedom is just an illusion.
Right.
And that makes total sense when we are talking about humans hurting other humans. But I feel like that defense completely falls apart when, you know, a tsunami wipes out a coastline or when a child gets a terminal disease.
Yeah, because no human exercised their free will to cause an earthquake.
Right. And this limitation is where Jans makes such a brilliant pivot. He moves the conversation away from our freedom to act and focuses instead on our freedom to know.
Because while the free will defense really struggles with natural disasters, Jans asks us to consider the underlying architecture of a universe where moral choices actually mean something.
And here's where it gets really interesting. If genuine freedom requires the option to fail, Jans asks a wild question.
Which is?
How would absolute, undeniable proof of God's existence impact that freedom? Like, imagine tomorrow we get 100% empirical certainty that God exists.
All right.
It's on the news. It's mathematically proven. And more importantly, we know this God is actively watching and judging everything we do with, like, an afterlife on the line.
Oh, it would completely obliterate the landscape of human motivation.
Totally. And Jans uses a brilliant pop culture reference to demonstrate this. He points to the TV show The Good Place, created by Michael Schur.
Oh, I love that show.
It's so good. And there is a crucial moment in the show where the main character, Eleanor, realizes that all her attempts to become a better person are actually, in her own words, corrupt.
Right, because she is only doing good deeds to earn points so she can stay in the good place and avoid eternal torture.
Exactly. Her motivation is entirely transactional. She isn't performing goodness. She is performing commerce.
Yes. And Schur's comedic premise elevates the discussion directly into the territory of Immanuel Kant.
Okay, let's bring Kant into this.
Well, what The Good Place dramatizes, Kant described in the 18th century as the heteronomy of the will.
Heteronomy.
Yeah. For Kant, if you do something simply because you expect a reward or you fear a punishment, you strip that action of its true moral worth.
Break that word down for us.
Sure. So hetero meaning other and nomos meaning law. Your will is being governed by a law outside of yourself.
Because the choice isn't really originating from your own character. The looming threat of punishment or the promise of a reward is literally making the choice for you.
Exactly. For an action to be genuinely moral, Kant argued it must be done out of duty. You do the right thing simply because it is the right thing to do, relying on your own autonomous reasoning.
Right.
And Jans points out that if God's existence, complete with a cosmic judgment system, were a scientifically proven fact, humans would be paralyzed by the awareness of the surveillance.
We'd be entirely incapable of acting out of pure duty.
Right. We'd just be trying to earn points.
But wait, I have to play devil's advocate here. Wouldn't absolute certainty still result in a functionally better world?
How do you mean?
Well, even if my motivation is entirely selfish, like even if I'm only feeding my neighbor because I have a terrifying fear of lightning bolts from the sky, a hungry person still gets fed.
That's true.
A world with less crime, less poverty, and more charity seems inherently superior, regardless of the internal psychological mechanics driving my actions.
Right. And Jans actually anticipates that utilitarian perspective.
Oh, he does.
Yeah. His counter is that if divine judgment were undeniably proven, the existential risk that defines the human experience completely vanishes.
The risk vanishes.
Yeah. Trust, hope, and true altruism require a void of certainty to exist. If you know for an absolute fact you will be eternally rewarded for giving away your money, your altruism is no longer a sacrifice.
It's just a highly calculated, risk-free investment.
Exactly. To prevent the universe from becoming this system of cosmic capitalism, God maintains what the philosopher John Hick called an epistemic distance.
Epistemic meaning relating to knowledge or the degree of its validation.
Exactly that. Hick argued that God must deliberately create a world that is religiously ambiguous.
Ambiguous how?
Like, it has to be perfectly capable of being interpreted as a purely naturalistic, material phenomenon without any divine presence at all.
Okay, so God provides enough hints to make faith possible for those who seek it.
But never enough empirical proof to remove doubt.
Wow. This distance ensures that humans can choose goodness for the sake of goodness itself, rather than acting like employees who only work hard when the boss is watching the security cameras.
That's a perfect way to put it.
And this tension between wanting undeniable proof and the destructive nature of that proof has fascinating historical parallels. Because humans have continually tried to bypass that epistemic distance and turn faith into, like, a mathematical equation.
What's fascinating here is how the absurdity of demanding proof has been captured in modern culture. Jans actually references Douglas Adams' satirical sci-fi series, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, that's such a great pull.
It is. In a famous passage, God essentially refuses to prove his own existence, stating, "Proof denies faith, and without faith I am nothing."
Right.
But then someone points out a piece of undeniable physical proof of intelligent design. So God, realizing the fatal logical contradiction of providing proof, promptly vanishes in a puff of logic.
I love that. It perfectly skewers the desire for empirical evidence in religion. Proof literally destroys the mechanism of faith.
It does.
But while Douglas Adams jokes about it, Blaise Pascal, the brilliant 17th century mathematician, made a deadly serious attempt to calculate belief.
Yeah, Pascal looked at the profound uncertainty of the universe and proposed what we now call Pascal's wager.
Pascal essentially treated salvation like a problem in probability theory.
Right, he laid out the math like a casino bet.
Exactly. He reasoned that human reason is simply incapable of knowing if God exists, so you have to place a wager.
Place your bets.
Right. If you bet that God exists by living a faithful, pious life, and you are right, your reward is infinite. Eternal salvation.
Not bad odds.
Right. And if you are wrong and the universe is just empty space, you lose very little. Maybe some Sunday mornings and a few earthly pleasures.
Sure.
On the flip side, if you bet God doesn't exist and you're wrong, your loss is infinite. Eternal damnation.
Any worst possible outcome.
So Pascal argued the only mathematically rational choice is to bet on God. It is maximizing your expected value.
Well, Jans vehemently rejects Pascal's wager. And he does so by leaning on the Kantian ethics we were just discussing.
Oh, right. The heteronomy thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Jans argues that Pascal encourages the exact kind of self-interested calculating behavior that divine hiddenness is meant to prevent in the first place.
Right.
Pascal's wager is the ultimate expression of the heteronomy of the will. It reduces the profound existential question of belief into a cosmic insurance policy.
It is the equivalent of pretending to love a billionaire just in case they leave you a fortune in their will.
Yes, exactly.
Like you might act perfectly devoted, you might do all the chores and say all the right things, you might even convince yourself over time that your affection is real.
But the underlying architecture of that relationship is purely transactional.
Right. You do not love the billionaire, you love the inheritance.
Yeah.
Jans is saying that if the point of human existence is to forge a genuine relationship with the divine and to develop true moral character, a calculated self-serving wager completely misses the point.
But, you know, the difficulty here is figuring out where the line is actually drawn.
What do you mean?
Well, if distance and uncertainty are necessary for genuine moral freedom, when does this epistemic distance stop being a helpful educational tool and start functioning exactly like sheer absence?
Oh, like, when does the teacher stepping out of the classroom to let the students learn independently start to look like there was never a teacher hired to begin with?
Precisely. And this is where Jans is forced to confront the heavy hitters of 19th and 20th century religious critique.
Mm.
We're talking about thinkers who stared into the exact same silence and ambiguity Jans describes, but drew entirely opposite conclusions.
Right, the critics.
Yes. We were talking about Ludwig Feuerbach, Karl Marx, and Sigmund Freud.
Okay, let's break their arguments down.
So Feuerbach argued that God is nothing more than a psychological projection. Humans took their highest ideals, you know, boundless love, perfect justice, infinite wisdom, projected them into the sky, and then forgot they were the authors of those ideals, bowing down to their own creation.
And Marx took a more sociological approach, right? He viewed religion as a mechanism of social control, the famous opium of the people.
Right.
He argued that religion was designed to soothe the economic pain of the working class, promising them an illusion of justice in the afterlife so they wouldn't rebel against their oppressors in this life.
And then Freud treated religion as a collective neurosis. In Freud's view, humans are terrified by the brutal, indifferent forces of nature, so we regress to an infantile state and hallucinate a cosmic protective father figure just to keep the terror at bay.
So all three of those critiques look at the hiddenness of God and conclude that God is hidden because God is just a human invention.
Exactly.
But Jans deploys a really robust philosophical defense against this, pointing out that these psychological and sociological critiques frequently rely on what is known as the genetic fallacy.
Right.
The genetic fallacy occurs when someone confuses the origin or the psychological cause of a belief with the actual truth of that belief.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah, sure. Like, if I believe it is currently raining outside because a fraudulent psychic told me so, my reasoning, the psychological origin of my belief, is entirely flawed.
Right. The psychic is a fake.
But my flawed reasoning does not change the meteorological reality. It still might actually be raining outside.
Right. So Jens argues that Freud might be completely correct about why humans possess a deep psychological terror that drives them to desire a cosmic father figure.
And Marx might be correct about how religion has been weaponized as a painkiller.
Yeah, but explaining the psychological or sociological need for a belief does not definitively prove the object of the belief is false. The human need for water doesn't mean water is an illusion.
That's a great analogy, but even if Jan survives Freud and Marx, he still has to face a much more difficult modern critique, doesn't he?
He does. Yes, the most potent counter-argument to Jan's comes from contemporary philosopher J.L. Schellenberg in what is known as the Argument from Divine Hiddenness.
Okay, what does Schellenberg say?
Schellenberg attacks the core premise of a loving God. He argues that if God is a perfectly loving being who actively desires a relationship with every single person, why does God remain entirely hidden from sincere, honest seekers?
Oh, so we aren't talking about skeptics who demand a burning bush or a miraculous sign in the sky before they'll believe.
No, not at all. Schellenberg is focusing on people who desperately want a relationship, who are open, who pray, who search intellectual and spiritual avenues for years, and who still find absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
It is. A perfectly loving parent would not remain hidden from a child who is lost in the woods, terrified, and actively crying out for them.
Because, I mean, if I want to have a genuine relationship with my friend, I don't hide in the woods so they can freely search for me without being overwhelmed by my presence.
Right.
If I hide so effectively that they spend years agonizing over whether I even exist, the relationship Jans is talking about becomes literally impossible.
It does.
At a certain point, maintaining epistemic distance doesn't look like a respectful boundary for my moral freedom. Mm. It just looks like total abandonment.
And Jans acknowledges this. He admits this is the primary limitation of his essay.
Really?
Yeah, he concedes that his framework is not a bulletproof mathematical proof of God that solves all suffering. It does not perfectly explain the tragic reality of the sincere seeker who finds only silence.
So where does that leave us?
Instead, Jans ultimately aligns faith with existentialism. Existentialist thinkers emphasize that humans are thrown into an absurd, ambiguous world without any guarantees. We are forced to make weighty, defining decisions in the dark.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? Well, Marius Jans isn't offering a scientific formula to prove God's existence in a laboratory.
Not at all.
He is suggesting a profound shift in how we view the vast unknown. He is arguing that uncertainty is not a flaw in the design of the universe. It might actually be the required operating system for a world where love, moral autonomy, and genuine trust have any actual weight. Faith isn't just a failure to find the facts or a crutch for the weak. It is a distinct, courageous posture toward the unknown, requiring us to act ethically without the safety net of guaranteed cosmic rewards.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the demand for absolute certainty, whether you are a devout believer, terrified of doubt, a strict agnostic, or a committed atheist demanding empirical proof, often robs us of the core human experience.
Right.
The struggle to discover our own values, to choose the good when nobody is looking and no reward is guaranteed, is precisely where our humanity is forged. The profound hiddenness of the ultimate answers might be the very space in which we are forced to grow up and take responsibility for ourselves.
It is the friction that creates character. I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on today, drawing on Jans's mention of John Hick and the arduous process of moral development.
Okay, let's hear it.
Jans points out that a world of free beings cannot be perfectly insulated from failure or vulnerability. But think about this. What if our capacity to feel pain, to be deeply uncertain, and to fail miserably isn't just the price we pay for free will?
What if it's the point?
Exactly. What if that exact vulnerability is the only biological and spiritual mechanism that makes it possible for us to experience empathy? So next time you feel frustrated by the lack of clear answers in your life, ask yourself, if you had the cheat sheet to the universe, would you still be capable of love?